Hello, or as they say here on Tasso Island in Sierra Leone, Topia, which means hello in Temne, an ethnic group from Sierra Leone, where I am right now. I am Axel Drioli. I am a wildlife sound recordist, a special designer, artist, musician, director, founder of Sounding Wild, and I'm currently working with my brother Ario on our overlanding expedition called Wings Across Continents, which is a 1.5 years journey following the bird migration on the west coast of Europe and Africa. And every month we stop at a different migration hotspot. For the first 3 weeks, Ario takes videos and pictures and 360 videos about the local migratory birds. I record sounds, and then at the end of our stay, at the fourth week, we create a documentary for the local communities in as many languages are spoken there, to share to the locals the stories of these migratory birds, where they go and how to recognize them, to understand just how incredible these birds are and the journey they do. And I chose to record here right now in this location, this intro, because over the last year, when we started the expedition in February 2023, we've been really coming across a lot of habitats, a lot of birds, a lot of humans. And here, right now, I'm literally on the edge of the shore. It's low tide, so the sea is quite far away from me, but fishermen are out there. I'm surrounded by local birds like village weaver, blue-cheeked bee-eaters, but also I can hear common sandpiper, I think, and whimbrels.
Hello, welcome to Wind is the Original Radio. This is a podcast where we have conversations with the best listeners in the world. I'm Melissa, and I'm hosting and creating this podcast for Earth FM. Today's guest is Axel Drioli, a wildlife field recordist and spatial audio designer, who is currently on an expedition following the East Atlantic Flyway. That means he's following the bird migration from Northern Europe to South Africa and is currently in Sierra Leone. You will notice that this episode is a little different than the others, and this is because we recorded the first installment quite some time ago, but Axel was kind enough to speak again with us from Sierra Leone. And now, on to our conversation. You've already been into some expeditions with work that have been produced and organized by other entities. But this time around, your project Wings Across Continents is completely done by Sounding Wild. Can you talk about how such organization and production goes?
I was part of a couple of expeditions where we were making 360 documentaries in different parts of Africa. So I was there with the UN and with UNICEF, and everything was organized by a film production company. So for me, it was about going there and making sure that get all the recordings, the sound recordings. But this time is different because we are, my brother and I are overlanding in our own vehicles, and we have to find the locations ourselves. So it's a different challenge. We are collaborating with Wetland Link International. They have a whole international network of wetlands all around the world. And in this case, they have an initiative called Migratory Birds for People, which links various different like visitor centers and wetlands on the East Atlantic Flyway, which is the one we're going to follow. And we're already in touch with most of them, but a few other ones that not part of this initiative. So we've got help from an organization to sort of put us in contact with them. So they gave us the connections, and then we have to create with the local communities and the local experts something for that place.
I would like to discuss a pertinent question. I think it's pertinent for a number of field recorders nowadays. How do you feel personally about doing a big majority of this project in the African continent, where almost its entirety has been colonized? And I mean specifically, how do you address that as a white European man who will be recording local wildlife and share a VR audio experience with communities?
Yeah. Well, it is a really interesting and really challenging expedition in places because, yeah, we don't want to go there and impose our own stories and our own way of telling stories. Our whole point of our expedition is to inspire people by sharing the wildlife they have there. The point is different cultures have also different ways of telling stories or perceiving stories or dealing with nature in general. Just because we are in Africa, it doesn't mean that everybody's connected to nature. You know, we cannot generalize people and a whole continent. So we're trying to be as honest as possible. And we want to make sure that, you know, when we go somewhere, we make people aware that we understand our position. And we want to collaborate with communities. We want to collaborate with people. And we want to also leave a legacy behind, because I think it's really important to leave something behind that is meaningful. That could be from a financial legacy or an educational legacy, an equipment legacy. We don't want to go there, grab something, and go back to our hometown or to our places and then share the story with our people. For us, it's not about the final project we're going to do, the final documentary that we're going to make in 1.5 years. We're definitely going to do it in the end, you know, in an important place, maybe the World Economic Forum, some other like really relevant places where lawmakers can see what we saw. But for us, it's really important to create the story every month. And every time we go somewhere, we want to connect with the local communities. And we bring all this technology, and we want to give the, you know, the chance to everyone on our journey to experience it, from people in Spain, France, UK, and also Senegal, Nigeria, Namibia, wherever we go. It shouldn't be any difference in the type of experience we create. If we create it in a way here, it should be also shared there. But we are really aware that, for example, in the wildlife filmmaking industry, there is a massive lack of showing, you know, films and documentaries that have been made somewhere to the local communities. Because distributors, for example, distributors in the UK or US, they focus on their own countries. They don't share it internationally as much. And mostly if you go to Africa or South America or Southeast Asia or India, they don't really distribute the stories there. So there is a big problem in the wildlife natural history documentary industry already. So we try to, you know, we try to be fair, and we want to also inspire other creators to do something similar, to take care of the, you know, the local communities and engage with them much more.
So in your previous work experience, was there something that was fundamental to question or to deconstruct an idea or a concept that you were not aware it could be seen or done in another way? Or maybe not done at all?
Yes. Well, in my family, I'm the first one after my grandpa that went outside Europe. My grandpa went for the world wars fighting as a soldier. And I'm the first one going out of Europe and going out of Italy. I'm originally from Italy and Northeast. So for me, you know, getting close or facing a completely different culture, I never experienced it before. And the first time that I went to Africa, for example, it was in South Sudan. First day straight away in one of the biggest refugee camps in Africa. And I was there holding my sound devices of $6,000 and then capturing stories of kids that, you know, they didn't have anything. Some of them didn't have a name or didn't have parents. And that started asking, I started asking myself, like, why am I here? What am I doing with myself here right now? So there was a bit of a weird feeling also being there. It didn't feel right. And then I went to Cambodia on my own just to record soundscapes and gibbons and hornbills in the Cardamom Mountains. And I had all my equipment and I recorded many great hours of, you know, amazing behaviors. And then I found this story of this local poacher. Chenda is the name of the ex-poacher. Now he became a local guide. And this Spanish ranger that left Europe and went there to do some work to help to get rid of poachers and convert them into local guides. And it was an interesting story. And so I decided to make a story there. And I've been there twice in 2019. I created this 360 story. But then I didn't share it with Chenda and the other people there. And I just felt it wasn't right. It wasn't the right way of doing things. I should have given priority to them, not people in Europe to film festivals, just to make, you know, a living out of that piece of story. I should have given them the priority first to show them the story. I mean, I'm just a guy, you know, I'm an urban guy. They had a normal life. They wanted to be a famous DJ. And now I ended up, like, you know, living in a car and recording wildlife sounds around, trying to be, you know, more conscious about how I treat other people and how I think about other people.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you for putting yourself on the spot there. Yeah, it's important.
Try. Same thing goes, I think, when we record music that we don't understand, maybe, and we play back or we remix it, and, you know, maybe it means something really deep for someone and we just take it for granted, you know, just because it sounds good, for at least from a point of view of a person that likes sounds. I'm really excited when I find, like, you know, some instruments that make some crazy sounds I've never heard before, which are obviously crazy for me because maybe for other people they're normal. I think, yeah, there are definitely moments where I was like, it was more about, like, I just want to be here now. I just want to feel it. I can't have this constant, like, need of taking the mic out to record it. I just need to enjoy this event and be here. And this is it. But yeah, I think there are other situations where maybe a set of recordings shouldn't be played back for respect towards someone. But that's, you know, why did you record it in the first place? That's, I think, the question that we should ask ourselves.
Yeah, that is right. And I think our culture nowadays is so strong about taking a register of everything.
Mm.
clearly, not only field recording, but all kinds of media, many times with ourselves in the center of the story, right? And it's prevalent with almost everyone taking pictures or videos of almost everything, almost everywhere. And it feels like that is imposing just a moment of being there. And from what I talk and read from other nature field recordists, for many of us, this practice, even though it consists of also taking something into media, it comes at times with a need of being present and maybe a need of quietness. What led you to nature field recording in specific?
I moved to London because I wanted to be a famous DJ. I wanted to go and study sound engineering because I loved hearing the claps on house music. They were sounding left and right, and they were sounding like they were in a room. And I was like, that's interesting. There was something sometimes that I could hear. There was some space in the mix. I was a lot into electronic music, dubstep, drum and bass, techno, French touch, this sort of stuff. And I was listening, and every time I could hear some recordings that were a bit more open and more spacious, I was like, oh, that's interesting. That's cool. And yeah, I wanted to go and study sound engineering, so I went to study at SAE Institute in London. And after 4 months, a friend of mine, a pair of headphones, I mean, he's like, Axel, listen to this. And there was the virtual barber shop, which is a binaural mix. And that blew my mind. And from that moment on, I was like, this is what I want to do now. And so I entered the world of spatial audio. So I started researching surround mixes, then ambisonics and all this stuff. And then I was making music with ambisonics and, you know, 20, 30 loudspeakers. And I'm like, oh, that sounds great. But something was always missing. I was like, music is meant, for me at least, my opinion, music is meant to be there on the frontal stage. And same thing for cinema. There is a screen there. As soon as you put a non-diegetic sound, something that is not on screen, it doesn't make much more sense anymore. So I want to use the full 360 environment sound field that I've got around me. And I was like, where can I find something like this in our world? And then I was like, oh, maybe soundscapes, urban recordings, some field recordings. So I went out and started recording in the city, recording cars passing by. But there was still something missing. And then I made some recordings. I think I was in France back then. I recorded some forest sounds. And by mistake, I recorded a dawn chorus without even knowing what that was. I was an urban guy. I was like, damn, that sounds cool. Wow. And they are so different. To me, one thing also that always annoyed me is music, how it needs to be on 12 tones, how people would always tell me that doesn't sound right or doesn't sound good. But nature always sounds right in the end. And it still sounds beautiful. I don't think that Robin goes there and just checks if he's, you know, on the minor key or a major key. So I was like, what's going on there? So I started getting more and more interested. And then I've seen that other people are interested. And I've done a couple of like workshops with Chris Watson. He was doing workshops here. And then I met other people that were into wildlife sound recordings. And then I found this group, the Wildlife Sound Recording Society. And I was like, all right, cool. I'm not the only one that likes this sort of weird stuff, because I was obviously a weirdo back then. I was the only one. And I realized, yeah, there is other people also that are interested in that. And I just started getting out in nature more and more. And I soon realized that the technology that I loved, spatial audio, took me out of the studio and reconnected me to nature. Technology reconnected me to nature for all series of reasons, but because I was looking for something that I was interested into. when I was a kid, I was always in the garden and I was always playing outside. So I had something ingrained into my brain, but I couldn't figure it out. And I think that was a sort of call that I answered, but I answered it thanks to spatial audio because that technology took me out. And the funny thing is that at the same time, my brother, Ario, was living in Brescia near Milan. He's a photographer and graphic designer. And he was studying graphic design. And he started going out camping and taking pictures of nature. And then he also reconnected to nature because he was like, I don't want to stay in a studio taking pictures of people. I want to be outside. I want to, you know, I want to explore nature. I want to see the different colors. I want to see the imperfections. I want to see beautiful things that happen all of a sudden that I didn't expect they would happen. And he also reconnected to nature thanks to technology in the end. And that's how we then, just before COVID, 1 year before COVID, I was like, I need to go and I want to drive in my car, record sounds and share them with people. I want to do something, you know, that is crazy and be able to stay in nature all the time. I don't want to have a company that calls me and tell me I can go to record wildlife in whatever in for 3 months or 3 weeks and then come back. I want to be all in nature all the time because that's also what I figured out. To learn about nature, need to be in nature. I cannot take it as a, you know, a hit of adrenaline on 30 minutes a day. I need to be there constantly to be able to really, really understand it and reconnect to it. We reconnected with nature because I think we can't talk about connection because we are nature. We are nature ourselves. It's just a matter of noticing it.
Mm-hmm. And how does deep listening, if at all, fits into your daily routine of being in nature?
Deep listening. Well, I think there is two ways of doing deep listening, I think, which I'm still learning. And sometimes I really struggle, mostly when I spend a lot of time in cities or working too much in front of a laptop. Well, deep listening in terms of like humans, for me, is about, you know, to not have barriers when I talk to someone that I don't know. They are from another culture and just like, you know, not judging. That's a big thing. Don't judge based on what they're saying or how they look or whatever. Just like, just listen, take it in, you know. That's on the human side, I think, is, if you, I don't know if you can call it deep listening, but it's not about the length. It's about like how you perceive other people's words and other people's ways of saying things. And in terms of nature, sometimes I still fall in the trap of going for a walk because I want to listen and then I still think about work or money or other people or whatever, right? But the worst is when I hear something and I think, oh, they would have made a really great recording before even thinking how great that behavior was, which sometimes it still happens, obviously, because I'm a geek inside, and that's my background. So I've been studying a lot about animal behavior and to understand how animals behave, to be able to also, instead of thinking, oh, that would have sounded great, more about like, why did it sound that great? Why did he do it? What's the reason behind it? So when my brain starts thinking about why that sound has been made, I think that's, for me at least now in this time of my life, that's to me deep listening because I'm completely present there because I'm observing. So that's to me deep listening.
Okay, and for you, is meditation anything like deep listening?
Yeah, definitely. I've been meditating on and off for the past 7 years now. The whole point of meditation is not to control anything. The whole point is not to control your brain. It's more about noticing thoughts. And when we notice a thought, that's the moment we are really present there, because we are listening to our mind and we are noticing what the mind is thinking. And by noticing it, you let the thought go, and then you have a moment of calm, but then another thought comes in. And this is what I'm trying to do when I'm out there. Because when I'm out there, I'm trying to notice things that are present there. If I would look at a phone, I'm not present in that environment because I'm on the phone, so my thoughts are going somewhere else. But if I am present in that environment and I'm focusing on, I'm noticing something, that to me is sort of meditation for myself. I have a similar feeling. And as soon as we practice it, we sort of like start noticing things, and we're going to feel something different, and we're going to benefit from it somehow. It's not easy. It takes time to understand it, but then on the long term, we can get something from it. You take meditation tools and you take them to your day-to-day life. So yes, when I'm in nature, I don't want to have a beeping phone. I can just like slow down now. I should notice what is happening right now physically in this space. So definitely going out to me becomes like a meditation practice.
I noticed in the latest years, maybe as climate catastrophe is unfolding, there's more urgency, I think, in talking about connection or reconnection with nature.
Yeah.
But there's a tendency of having more people even in urban settings. And it just might feel completely unreachable sometimes for people living in those kind of spaces. And in that regard, what would be your advice for people to just, you know, start to get a bit familiar with more than human life and using listening?
Okay, first of all, going to quiet places is a privilege now, isn't it? Being able to be in a quiet place, it's really privileged. It's not something that you can access that easily. So I imagine London. I lived in London for 9 years, and it's been pretty hardcore at times. But sometimes I could find places that weren't too far away from my home that had a little bit of noise, but the wildlife that was there was making such a racket, such a big noise, that I was only focusing on them there. So I think being aware of what's around, even going to your own garden and being able to just really focus on what you're listening to, not to the birds in general, but to that bird. If you talk about sounds of nature in Europe, that's most what we hear, like birds, right? Biophonic sounds. Just go there and start recognizing them. There are so many tools now that can help us to recognize them and get familiar with those ones. So I think it should become, even though there is traffic noise or like anthropogenic noise, make it constant, make it part of your day-to-day walk to work, and make sure that if you hear something that sounds animal or wildlife, just focus on that a little bit and learn it. Be curious about it. I think the curiosity is important. I mean, if you are able to go to a really quiet place, go to the really quiet place. But sometimes the quiet places are not that active in terms of wildlife. So it depends a bit what we're looking for. To me, the reconnection, that's my own opinion, after I read a little bit, there is this thing of being connected and being in contact with nature. When we are in contact, if we go for a half an hour run, and we just run, we think about our work and we think about getting into the time, but we are running in nature, that's just being in contact. We are getting a hit of dopamine from the green that we see around, even if it's farmland and there are pesticides everywhere and there are, you know, the biodiversity is super low. But if we go to nature and we notice how biodiversity is, how many birds are there, and we just start asking ourselves questions. I'm talking about birds now, but it could be about picking up mushrooms or like looking at moths. It could be anything that interests you. But that curiosity, I think, is really key. So getting that curiosity starting towards something, then digging deeper into it, then that sort of like reconnects you to wildlife. And it needs to be accessible because people have, you know, mortgages, kids, something like that. So we need to find ways for everyone to reconnect to nature. And, you know, it could be just the house sparrows. Count the house sparrows that are outside your house and recognize how many females and males are there. That's already connecting. And then you start listening to the different calls they have, and you start differentiating between alarm calls and songs. It needs to start gently. And I don't think going one weekend per month in a really quiet place is the solution. I think it should be constant. It's a slow process. Like, nature is slow, isn't it? My brother and I, we come from a city called Trieste on the Slovenian border in Italy. And I was always excited about exotic sounds, mostly living in London. You know, I had the classic blackbirds and all this stuff around, but I wanted something more exotic. So I traveled around Africa and Cambodia to look for exotic sounds. And then I went back home and I was like, well, what's going on here? And it was like a summer. And I was like, let's put a recorder in this area. Our grandpa left us. We inherited a piece of land in a forest, completely useless. We can't do anything. Useless, I said, we can't build on it, which is even better, obviously, for us now. And I went there to check it out, and I figured out it was super quiet. It was in a little, like, valley in between two hills with two highways on each side, like 15, 20 kilometers away. But this valley, I don't know, I mean, probably the sound of the traffic just goes over the valley, so it doesn't drop into the valley. And I was like, oh, I'm gonna have to record here. So I leave a recorder there, and it's like a 20 minutes walk up a hill. It's not nice, mostly in the scorching sun. It's pretty crazy. And I was like, all right, cool. I carry all my equipment, and I go there, and I drop the recorder. I leave it there for one night, so unattended that time. I was like, well, let's see what's going on. Come back the day after, check the recordings, and I hear these howlings. And I was like, what is that? Remember, I didn't know much about nature. And I was like, what, do we have wolves, like, near my house? What is going on? So I asked a couple of friends, and they're like, no, those are golden jackals. So they are, golden jackals are sort of like a medium-sized dog looking like a wolf. Golden color, I mean, quite yellowish. And they go around in packs, and they've been expanding all around Europe, coming from the Danube Delta in Romania and that area. And they are expanding everywhere. And there are so many packs where we come from in Trieste and all around the forest, in the forest, all around the city. That's crazy. I've literally been living in London, traveling all around the world to record the exotic sounds. And I've got literally a sort of wolf-like animal, the house, every night behind my house, almost. So it was pretty crazy. That made me realize how we need to listen more to our local environment. Every time I go back to my hometown, I drop a recorder there. So sometimes 2 months, sometimes a week, at least 3 days, 4 days, I put the recorder there. And they always howl too far from the microphone. I can't get close to them. And I use these ambisonics mics. So what I do, I started using 3 ambisonics mics, orient all of them towards north and trying to pinpoint where the calls come from to sort of like get closer and closer to the packs. And remember, 3 Zoom recorders, 3 microphones, 3 tripods, so 20 kilos every day up and down. Spent the last 3 years trying to get a good recording. Haven't managed to. And then one day I was at my mum's place close to a forest. I was literally in the bathroom, and then I was there. and I hear howling literally outside the window. A pack of golden jackals arrived there, and I was there just at 10 p.m. when they usually call, and they literally started howling like 200 meters away from my mom's house after like 3 years that I spent walking up and down a hill with 20 kilos of equipment. They were just outside my doorstep. I dropped the microphone there and I've got a recording, the closest recording I could get. And I think this recording, yes, there is traffic noise, but that sort of, to me, it means that we don't have to go too far to have crazy encounters with wildlife. It's not perfect, it's not a pristine recording, but it's just, for me, it's just so powerful thinking that we can have these sort of things happening around our houses. We just need to notice it and hear it and be able to recognize it.
Wow, this is amazing. And I agree that we are very quick to devalue what is immediately around us, but it feels very appealing to go far and go look for something that is very different. But, you know, even watching some ants on the ground,
yeah,
they are amazing.
Yeah, definitely.
I think it's a matter of us tuning in to what is around us.
You just said it, tuning to what's around, yeah.
Yeah. And something else I'd like to ask your view on is about the romanticization of nature. I think this happens to an extent, and it feels very prevalent in nature sounds, actually. Like,
yeah.
Pretty bird song, trickling leaves, relaxing streams, and definitely they can be that, almost objectively. However, I wonder if it wouldn't be just more beneficial for us to cultivate a more honest view on nature and also embrace its ruthless side. Because nature can be very ruthless, right? It's just inherent to it.
Yeah.
And with sound specifically, it doesn't necessarily mean a big predator eating a small animal. So we don't have to go gore like that. But
yeah.
For me, some winds can feel oppressive. Big crashing waves can be oppressive also, or can feel oppressive.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about this?
Oppressive or also ugly?
Yeah, we can also do ugly, sure.
For example, I mean, ugly, right? Sandwich terns or like loads of seabirds. They don't sound romantic. They sound like taking a knife and rubbing it on a cheese grater. The sandwich turn sounds like that. That's really harsh. It is really harsh. But yeah, we need to be aware of these sounds. But that's what happens in wildlife in general, wildlife storytelling. We want to romanticize wildlife and, you know, dramatize it. Or that doesn't look nice, or that does look nice, or that sounds bad, that sounds romantic, that sounds horrible. Well, it was interesting. We started releasing albums in a sort of like concept album format. So that's something also that you asked me a while back. You're like, actually, why did you release like 10 tracks for a minute and a half of bird sounds? Well, I'm trying to find ways, because for me also, it's like, how can I get into the pace of people? How can I get people that have a fast pace to listen to nature sounds? Because I can listen to 1 hour recording, you can also, but most people, after 10 seconds, they scroll down. So how to get something to grab their attention? And we had this recording of a black woodpecker, which sounds really like squeaky. And it's not relaxing. But some people were like, oh, the black woodpecker sounded sick. I'm like, well, really? Well, I wasn't expecting that from you. Most people would say, I liked everything, but the black woodpecker wasn't relaxing at all. And I'm like, yeah, but nature sounds doesn't mean that you need to go and meditate with nature sounds. Sometimes there is a whole story behind. They're really harsh. But I think that's also, that's a connection with how we feel about nature, how we feel about walking at night for example, that people are really scared about it because there is the conception of, like, you know, we are in darkness. And obviously I'm a white guy in his 30s, so easy for me to talk about being safe. But, you know, lots of people don't feel safe when they go in nature because, you know, other men are the main issue, not tigers or like lions, at least in Europe. But as soon as you figure out that if you go with someone or you go alone in nature, in darkness, and you just get comfortable, you realize that all the fear is induced by how culture tells us that we have to feel fear for that in that moment. For example, Jaws, the film Jaws, it was in the 70s when they released Jaws. And from that moment, the idea, you know, shark, they should have been exterminated from the planet. But that was just a movie that Steven Spielberg made because he thought it was fun. And then just a few months ago, it was like, oh, I regret making it because I've seen what this thing has done to sharks. People culturally got scared of sharks because of a story or because it's been told they should be scared, but they're not dangerous. I mean, yes, they are dangerous, but not at that level.
No, they wouldn't actively be trying to kill you, I suppose.
Yeah, and darkness can be dangerous if you don't look at where you're walking or if you don't see exactly where you are walking. Yes, of course it can be dangerous. You break your leg and you're in the middle of the night and no one comes there and save you. Of course, that can be dangerous, but that's just up to you. But chances of having an animal that comes to you and eats you at night in a forest in Europe are extremely low. The problem is humans.
How do you think that someone can overcome those innate feelings of being scared, being alone in the darkness, in nature?
How to do that? I'm not forcing people to go out in nature in dark, but think about the possibility of going there. And if we watch too many horror movies, it doesn't mean that it's actually that dangerous. Maybe you can go in small groups, two people, that's definitely safer. And then when you know you're really safe, you can be on your own. I think it's just the best moment. I feel so free when I'm walking alone in darkness. At the beginning, I remember when I was going out the beginning, first times when I was alone in the dark, I could hear something and I would just like, you know, my heartbeat would just jump. I would be so scared and I would start sweating, even though it was like -1. But then I turn and there was nothing. And maybe I see a bird flying or, pigeons, you know. So it's fine, you know. And actually, I love feeling a bit insignificant in that moment, because we are not made to live in darkness. We can't see anything. We can hear loads, but we can't see anything. So we are really vulnerable, and I loved being vulnerable in that moment, being insignificant against nature. Just here, you're just like nothing. You're just a piece of meat that walks. So it's like, you know, you're really nothing. And I love that feeling. And that's the beginning for me to deep listening then. Then I can just feel really, really present there. Sensory deprivation, mostly the visual side, is something that we should try. I mean, one half a day that I'm always going to remember, I think, is when I was studying and I asked my girlfriend to take me around the city during the day to have a normal day, but completely blindfolded. So I woke up and I didn't open my eyes and I put a blindfold on my eyes and I just spent the whole day blindfolded. It's funny how you start at home, you know where you are, you know where you're going. You can sort of like, you remember where you're going. But then when you exit the house, usually I was turning always right to catch the train. But then I asked her, can we just go left? And so that moment, I completely lost perception of where I was. And then I started listening for real because I couldn't picture things. So I started listening, you know. There I realized that how much louder the sound the tires are compared to the engine, for example. hearing is such an incredible sense, and it's always on. We never switch it off. We can't cover it. We can't see if something comes from behind us. So, yeah, removing it for a little bit, I think, is great. It's a good practice to do sometimes, to be more aware of how we listen. What I gained in that afternoon, it was just mental. It was crazy, the learnings that I gained that afternoon. It completely changed the way that I listen. That was, like, pivotal. That was, like, wow. I learned so much in that half a day. That was the beginning of, let's say, listening. So it wasn't related to nature, but it was just listening, opening the ears, noticing things in a different way. Thanks to that, I started listening differently.
Amazing, amazing experiment. I hope this inspires many people listening to do something similar safely. Do you have a favorite natural sound?
My favorite sound? Well, herons are pretty cool, I think, are really cool sounds, yeah, because they remind me of how we think the pterodactyls sound, but they maybe didn't sound like that, because, you know, probably they used the sound of herons in Jurassic Park. I think herons are brilliant. They sound super cool, you know. When I was in UK, people were telling me, oh yeah, they don't make much sound. And I'm like, what? In the Camargue, they were like super vocal, and they sounded so aggressive and so prehistorical, so cool. That's one of my latest favorite sounds, honestly.
In the last few years or so, what have been the subjects related to your wildlife field recording practice that you have been wanting to learn more, and why?
Well, in the last 4 years, I've been really reading about animal behavior and learning a lot about animals. And I really wanted to get a book about cultures within different groups of animals, if there is any culture. We associate culture to humans, but there is some culture also into animals. And I found this book called Becoming Wild by Carl Safina. There is also an audiobook. And I was like, all right, cool. Now I'm going to learn something about cultures. And obviously, cultures happen through communication. So it's a whole book about communication and between animals and all about vocalizations. And it's a great book because it sort of makes you understand how important, for example, small groups of animals of the same species are. Sperm whales, they are spread around the oceans, and they have small groups, and each group speaks differently than other groups. So if we lose one group of one region, we're going to lose that culture forever. It's literally like losing a language. You know, when big companies are talking about rewilding, right, we're going to recreate that nature on this other side, I'm like, well, you can have the same species there, but it doesn't mean they're going to have the same culture. Even macaws, when they talk about communication between macaws, to us they are like squeaks and whatever, but for someone that's been working with macaws for like 20 plus years, they're like, this group of macaws speak differently than these other ones. Chimps, and also to other birds. That's a great book, I think, to read. That was one. And then, well, another one to be aware of is Songs of Humpback Whales by Roger Payne. I think that's something that we should all be aware of, this album. That's the album that's been printed the most ever, I think, in records. Then another podcast is Into the Wild. Just a podcast I thought that was pretty interesting about animals in general, just to have a listen. Thank you.
Hello, you just listened to Axel Drioli. You can find all the things we talked about, all links and references in the episode's notes. This is also our last episode for this season. We really hope you have been enjoying learning and getting to know more about nature, field recording and all the things around it. It would be great to hear from you if you want to reach out to us at Earth FM. Earth FM is a non-profit repository of hundreds of immersive soundscapes from around the world recorded by the best artists. If you resonate with our mission, please consider supporting us by becoming a member or donating on www.earth.fm. Join us in the effort of awakening together to the wonders and preciousness of Mother Earth.